Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking to Dr. Obert Bernard Mlambo about his really original, really discipline-pushing, interdisciplinary book that I think raises a lot of questions in multiple areas. So I'm quite excited to talk about it. The book is titled Land Expropriation in Ancient Rome and Contemporary Zimbabwe, Veterans, Masculinity, and War. And it was published by Bloomsbury in 2022. And without giving too much away, as the title suggests, this is a really interesting comparative history in a way, but that's probably not doing the ideas their full justice. Thankfully, the author is here to do it properly. So Bernard, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you, Miranda, for having me. I'm very pleased. Thank you again. I'm very happy to be here. Yeah.
Well, we're very happy to have you. But before we dive too far into the book, could you start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explaining why you decided to write this book?
Yes, I am a classicist by profession, specifically a Roman historian. But I do quite a lot of things in terms of my research, areas of interest and specialization, stemming, of course, from my education, which saw me doing a first degree in classical studies, an honors in classics. Also in the first degree, I did history, world history, so to speak, is one of my majors. And I also majored in classics. And then a master's where I narrowed my specialization to do Roman history, and of course a PhD in Roman history. But of course, it's again a comparative investigation of issues to do with the ancient Roman world and contemporary Zimbabwe. I'm currently an associate professor of classical studies and history at the University of Zimbabwe, and I'm due to take a position at Rhodes University this semester. Yeah, so basically that's about myself.
Thank you for starting us off with that. And as you mentioned, this book is comparing ancient Rome and contemporary Zimbabwe. How did you decide to compare these two against each other?
Thank you very much for a very important question. The question which I have always come across whenever people interested in my book wish to discuss the book with me. And I've always been enthused to reflect quite, you know, in detail, because there's never a single answer to that question, but perhaps a more nuanced response would be quite helpful to anyone who would be interested in reading the book. So basically, I have always said to myself, historical alienationism normally was that the ancient Roman world, for instance, is so different from the present that it has scarcely any value for contemporary Africa, or in particular, contemporary Zimbabwe. So, for example, to say we are in a totally new world where nothing from the ancient Romans could be of use to us now is a form of historical alienationism. I'm trying to give a bit of explanation in terms of what I mean by historical alienationism. So whether or not historical alienationism can be associated with a definite thinker or proponent, my book has some answers to it. And I'm not able, of course, to exhaust all the nuances surrounding the question that you've asked me, but perhaps I'll just try to, you know, touch on the pressure points that would, you know, cast a light on the question that you've just asked me. So my attitude to ancient Rome in the book was shaped by how much ancient Rome resembles my present circumstances as a Zimbabwean. So I do not accept an anachronism, of course, according to which the resemblance between ancient Rome and contemporary Zimbabwe is duly exaggerated. But even if one tries to avoid making ancient Rome a carbon copy of Zimbabwe, that does not mean they have nothing in common. To the extent that humans of the past and present can both be human, can both be called humane, they have presumptively something in common sufficient to justify the use of the same term human for both. And thus what happened in ancient Rome is not irrelevant to contemporary Zimbabwe in the sense that a similar human condition applies to both ages. One would of course go on to ask, are ancient Romans the same humans as Zimbabweans? My book thus proposes an approach to history for the study of classical and African culture, an approach which does not overstress the difference of the past and the present in the fashion of extreme progressivism or historical alienationism. So this approach may be termed objective humanism. It takes into account the objective similarities and differences between ancient Romans and contemporary Africans, doing justice, of course, to the difference of historical periods and cultures. So the book's positive view of humanity gives an incentive for interest in human history and culture and a motivation to persist in intercultural dialogue. So a belief in common humanity, for me, offers a background for the comparison of humans and societies belonging to different cultures, places, and times. I've also looked at scholarship dealing with more or less related topics, for example, how 2013, who refers to the use of far-out comparisons in the grounded theory approach, which is an approach to social scientific research proposed by scholars such as Glaser and Strauss, and further articulated by Strauss and Corbin. So classical antiquity, for example, is very interesting, you know, human situations, which if you want to look at it, really seem like they are replicating themselves. And my interest particularly was provoked by such very close, you know, and intersecting, you know, human situations to do with challenges of a veteran phenomenon in the late Roman Republic and contemporary Zimbabwe. In short, this is the philosophical underpinnings behind my choice of the present study contained in the book that we are discussing. Over to you, Miranda.
Thank you for giving us such a kind of helpful context and foundation, not just about the decision of the cases, but as you how you've approached them in comparison. Because now I get to ask you about kind of all the details of that with that philosophical foundation in mind. Turning to the first word in the subtitle of the book, veterans, if we're thinking about these case studies together in the way that you've just described, to what extent was the idea of what a veteran was similar between ancient Rome and Zimbabwe? And what do you think we can learn by comparing what a veteran means across these two cases?
Thank you very much. What an interesting question. First of all, I would say differences are bound. In talking of veterans, or perhaps let me start by looking at it from first of all, ancient Rome itself, before I consider the contemporary example of Zimbabwe. The term veteran, Miranda, in the late Roman Republic, and of course in Roman Republican scholarship, classicists would know, or specialists in Roman history would know, that it is used to refer to soldiers with a special loyalty to their commander in the period of the client army era. That is the time of Marius, Sulla, Pompey, and later Caesar and Octavian. And of course, my definition of veteran in 1st century BC Rome is informed more closely by Appian, who records that veterans were those who fought on behalf of another. That is, they are seen by Appian, the historian, as client soldiers. And we do have a Greek word for that, which means literally one who fights on behalf of someone. And this Greek word can be pronounced in Greek as euperagoni, gonistes, related to eupere gonizondo, meaning one who fights on behalf of another, or a champion. But perhaps we do not have to limit it to that category in Roman history or the Republican era itself. We can also go on to talk of citizen soldiers returning from frontier warfare in the second century BC. They also do constitute part of the Gracchi problems, who may not, you know, squarely fit in this category, although they actually form part of the historical process of the problem, which became a factor in Roman politics in the first century. But of course, we may confidently say the time-expired soldiers of the legions are also part of what should be referred as veterans, to the extent that we can say the term veteran in the late Roman Republic does not necessarily imply even advanced age or long service. In the second and first century BC, recruits who expected to serve not more than, they were expected to serve not more than 6 continuous years, since 6 years of service were counted as the complete full service. And anyone who had completed the 6 years was entitled to share in any available premium. But according to Polybius, foot soldiers served for 16 legal years, and the cavalry served for 10 legal years in his time, that is the time of Polybius. However, the client army area tended to disregard these strict limits, as retired soldiers could be enlisted into private armies of individual generals inspired by rewards in the form of acreage, booty, or money. Perhaps it is helpful as I try to give a clearer concept of this term veteran when it comes to the Roman Republic. The idea that the veterans were sort of mercenaries holding out for financial compensation was also implied. We have several references across the primary texts, and I may here refer to Lucan, book 5 from line 244, if you want, onwards, where there is mention of this idea of, there's a word vendetat, so to speak, which term suggests that financial rewards and not just rewards of valor were sought by veterans. So there are two important factors to consider when we conceptualize the term veteran in the late Roman Republic. They were rewarded first and foremost for their acts of valor. They were rewarded as heroes who fought for Rome, wars of expansion, and sometimes even during civil wars, for example, the civil war between Marius and Sulla, where Sulla would have to reward his soldiers after, you know, the civil war between Julius Caesar and Pompey, where veterans also had to be fobbed off, you know, in terms of compensation, where they received land and even money. So it is a reward of valor, and also generally to be understood is financial compensation, broadly speaking. This is how I generally conceptualize the term veteran. But most importantly, when we talk of valor, when we talk of heroism, we are now interested in the propaganda and, you know, the tendency to manipulate ideals of power by way of posturing, exploiting conventional ideals of power, which became an in thing in the, you know, construction of ideals of power and then a creation of gradations of, you know, machismo, and of course bearing, you know, some implications when it comes to how resources were to be distributed. We are now having the rules of the jungle here, where the fittest person could be able not just to claim what they deserved, but also to even expropriate because they had the power and the macho to do that. In this total disregard of the constitution, in total disregard of rules, in total disregard of rights to property, because of this kind of mentality that it gripped, excuse me, in the kind of politics at Rome, where Roman generals ended up, you know, usurping political power and, you know, getting political gravitas and support from their hordes of veterans who supported their cause. I quickly turn on to Zimbabwe, where I also try to carve in and try to nuance and explain this concept in order also that it may help the listener to understand the points of conducts, which of course encouraged me to, or enabled me to come up with this interesting comparison. In Zimbabwe, of course, when I'm talking of veterans, I am interested in the adult population of guerrilla fighters who fought in the Rhodesian Civil War or War of Independence. These actually share a more or less similar ideology of the Liberation War, and their identities are grounded in the anti-colonial struggle, which culminated in the country's independence in 1980. And was actually the work of men and women from various political organizations in the country. And these men and women are the archetypal embodiments of the liberation struggle. That I've mentioned women shows a marked difference in the two worlds of veterans, that is the late Roman Republic and the Zimbabwean case study, in that there were no female soldiers in ancient Rome, but in Zimbabwe already we have females participating in war and also claiming a stake of rewards after the war as veterans. So, yes, as was in Rome, in contemporary Zimbabwe, the veteran is claiming for land, most importantly, as was the case in Rome, and also for money and recognition generally in society, simply because of the valorous acts that they claim to have exhibited to save the country and to even claim the country back from the jaws of colonialism. So perhaps this can end up being, you know, a continuous explanation of this concept, because there are so many things that I could say. Maybe it is important that I end there, Miranda.
Well, I do actually want to ask you kind of things based off of that answer. So obviously the rewards and land part of it, but I'd like to stay on this point of valor and heroism for a moment, because there are such kind of key similarities that you've described in the importance that the veterans attach to this. But you talk about in the book that there's actually a difference in one aspect, or maybe a few aspects between them. And I wanted to ask about the view of battle scenes, because so often when we think of valor and heroism, there's certain images that come to mind, right? Of maybe what a monument looks like, or a parade, or something like that. And so if this is so important to the veterans in both instances, can you tell us about this difference in terms of battle scenes between them, and kind of how that plays into what valor meant, what heroism meant, and what it felt like to veterans for those things to be recognized?
Thank you very much for a very interesting question. Valor is a very important notion in the two worlds of veterans, in the sense that valor is not a status that one could wake up one morning are claiming to have without the evidence to that effect. And this evidence in both worlds of veterans is attested by one's track record. So there's a narrative of one's involvement in very dangerous battle scenes, where they, for instance, got scarred, where they, for instance, lost a limb, and where, for instance, some of their fellow comrades actually fell and died in battle. But that is not all. Valor was also constructed in the manner in which one behaved in the battleground itself. People would do extraordinary things in full view of their fellow comrades, sometimes being warned not to do that. I have a very interesting example, for instance, in the contemporary Zimbabwean case study. These are details that emerged from the interviews that I conducted with veterans of the liberation struggle. The late liberation war hero by the name Solomon Mujuru, on the battlefield, he would not even hesitate to walk whilst guns were blazing without trying to duck or without trying to crawl or without trying to avoid the bullet. He would scream, he would run from one end to the other in terms of the arrangement of his men, rearranging, shouting to say, don't do that. And some people would even run to, pull him down to say, General, this is dangerous. Dangerous as it was, after the war, he remained one of the iconic figures of Zimbabwe's Rhodesian War of Independence because of such acts. And he is, up to now, though dead, still remembered for such courageous acts. Fearless is the word. And this is quite characteristic of what obtained in the late Roman Republic. It is not just posturing for the sake of it, but it is actually a belief which in real life situations translates into actions which defy the logic of one would conduct themselves in such dangerous situations. But heroes would confront death and look death in the eye. That's how valor is constructed between the two sets of veterans. They really seem like they are taking it from the same hymn book, although these societies are separated by 2,000 words. So another similar malaise concerns, of course, the question of those who then after the war, when they are being viewed in society, they come in society often psychologically wounded or traumatized. And of course, to a world that little understands them and in which they feel alienated and sometimes hostile. So when they do come, such veterans who might have exhibited extraordinary valor on the battlefield, in their societies back home during peace, they may feel that their very masculinities are being threatened. And then an anxiety symbolized by violence and failure to settle peacefully in society is quite characteristic when one looks at both societies. Hence, a very interesting point of comparison, which I explore in the book, looks at violence emanating from perceptions of the notion of heroism, the notion of valor itself, and how it ends up.
Mm. Thank you for explaining. Thank you for explaining that comparison. I think it is really interesting to kind of think about how these two aspects go together, given that the iconography we might think of as being really different. Obviously, we don't have, for example, photographs of ancient Rome. And yet, when you're describing them to us, the similarities really do become quite apparent. So now that I've asked you a bit more about valor and heroism, I'd like to turn to the other piece of your earlier answer that I wanted to pick up on, which is, of course, the idea of land as a reward, expropriation of land particularly. Can you walk us through the conceptions of masculinity in both of these places and times and how this supported expropriation of land?
So here we are dealing with three things. And in your question, clearly you have the concept of veteran and the concept of masculinity, and of course, the concept of land. I would start by looking at the relationship between the concepts of veteran and masculinity and how they are used as key concepts in the book. I do use them as key concepts in the book in analyzing the relations of military men. And we need to take note that these are not just the relations, but relations that are particularly contextualized in a crisis situation of resource redistribution, ownership and accumulation in both societies. And in this case, the resource at the center stage of my analysis is land. So these relations, Miranda, generally involve two broad areas: relations of the action of the general upon his forces, or vice versa, and relations of control over the conferment or distribution of material benefits. This obviously takes us to the issue of land hunger, because it is this problem of land hunger that has caused this kind of innovative positioning of the veteran in both societies, and how he innovatively and intelligently appropriates qualities of his body, physical body, and the narrative of the war in which he has participated to claim for land. So there's discontent in both societies over land inequalities, motivated, of course, by the fact that the rich and the political elites accumulated vast tracts of land at the expense of the majority of the poor, creating in the process the problem of a poor peasantry, a hungry and landless city mob, and most importantly, the veteran phenomenon. And such a phenomenon is very dangerous, and that's the one that is at the center of the book. So naturally, analysis would unpack and give nuance to the various contextual factors and how they intersect to explain the construction, performance, if you want, appearance of land-based masculinities in the two societies. But this is not all. When we say that, remember, Miranda, we are comparing two societies. We are comparing very disparate societies without any connection sociologically, without any connection historically, without any connection, temporally. How does it happen that these factors can actually make sense in terms of trying to, explain the two societies and answering certain questions that arise in the study of Roman history, for example, or the study of the contemporary case study of Zimbabwe? Once we talk of the concept of veteran, once we talk of the concept of masculinity, we are in the field of anthropology. And anthropologists would easily see a connection in trying to study the human condition by paying due diligence to what they call practice theory. And this is what I use to study the cultural context of the Roman Republic and contemporary Zimbabwe, using, of course, the context of Zimbabwe, which I am able to access live and also through text, to then explain the function of the element of performativity, which in the Zimbabwean scenario comes out clearly in demonstrations, of course, and also in demonstrating the role of the masculine ideal in the broader matrix, dynamics, and mechanics of land expropriations. And then I would argue to say these tools that I do have, or methodologies that are at my disposal, because I could still interview a Zimbabwean veteran. He's around and I can still see him doing his thing on the streets and on the farm. It is not possible when it comes to ancient Rome. This then helps me to explain that bit which the ancient historians did not have at their disposal in explaining to us scenarios of land expropriation and demonstrations in the city of Rome by hordes of veterans. So I'm taking ethnography from a modern case study and use it as a lens to try and conjecture what might have been the case with hordes of veterans demonstrating in the city of Rome, demonstrating for rewards, demonstrating for land. This is how the intersection can, in a nutshell, be explained. Miranda, over to you.
That's, I think, all of your answers have been a very interesting example of kind of why this comparison helps us in terms of studying. I think that answer, perhaps especially that idea that we can take information that is available now and use
and
that
maybe,
to think about what happened.
Sorry, Miranda, maybe before you go, that there's an idea that has just crossed my mind.
Please.
Which I think is quite a powerful way to, look at things as they occurred in the late Roman Republic. And of course, as conveyed by the historians that I studied, Dio Cassius, for example, Appian, Suetonius, and so on. We know that since culture in anthropological terms can be understood as a matter of publicly observable symbols and rituals, and the organization of discourse and practices, it is actually therefore possible to study connotations of the veterans' boots, for example, and other military paraphernalia as materials that were central in the construction and performance of land-based masculinities in the late Roman Republic. There is, of course, no time for me to elaborate on that, but there are sections in the book where I actually zoom in around the veteran's boot as it was appropriated in the politics of power and land claims. And I developed that to really show how the veteran's boot, a soldier's boot, was an important tool in the construction of a land-based masculinities, using, of course, the performative visuals that are accessible to me in a Zimbabwean context to try and contrast with the Roman example to see how even the two scenarios are different. There are certain appeals to objects, certain appeals to bodily substances in both cases of ancient Roman Zimbabwe by veterans to use as a way to claim for land rewards.
Thank you. Thank you for adding that in. It actually gives me something I'd like to ask a bit about on that point of similarities and differences for the kind of public performance side of this demonstrating by veterans. Because you do talk a lot about in the book sort of these group dynamics, the visible performances of groups of veterans, and that in many ways, there are quite a lot of similarities, as you've just discussed, between ancient Rome and contemporary Zimbabwe. One difference I wonder if you can tell us about is around the body aspect of it. Living veteran bodies, dead veteran bodies. How did these group performances and group actions of veterans differ when it comes to this aspect of bodies?
Thank you very much, Miranda, for a very fascinating question. And even when I was doing the writing and research for the book, I really found it quite quite interesting, quite fascinating. So it all boils down to how the physical body of a veteran was framed in the two societies. So here we really need to think of the narratives and accounts relating to war veterans that I examine in the book. And their purpose, in my view, serve to frame several issues within the context of masculinity, serve to frame several issues within the context of land expropriation, and serve to frame several issues within the context of the political economy of the physical bodies of the war veteran. And I've developed the argument that research has shown that masculinity, as socially constructed, is not always related to biological sex. Masculinity, even in ancient Rome, if you want to look at it that way, was associated with heroic actions, was associated with sacrifice, was associated with dedication to one's nation. Now we want to look at it this way. How does a Roman veteran with that positioning, as a manly man, what does he do? Inevitably, with that positioning, as manly men, Roman veterans with that positioning, inevitably came a host of other social meanings, came a host of other social expectations, and came a host of other social identities upon which they acted, adopted or adapted in the context of their physical bodies' involvement in land claims, contestations, and expropriations. Now we have a whole universe of how a Roman veteran is complicating the scenario, of how a war veteran is complicating his worldview of valor, mixing this concept with that concept, mixing this idea with this idea. And in his posturing, he's not relying on one thing, as I've just shown you. When we cross over to contemporary Zimbabwe, at a generic level of looking at the instrumentalization of masculinity and the resources that come with that kind of posturing, generally we see a broad similarities across the two societies. But if, as you have rightly indicated, Miranda, I really looked closely to see how constructions of masculinities in the two case studies may not necessarily be pigeonholed as if they were similar or are similar in every respect. I have noted the idea of spirituality, where, for example, in contemporary Zimbabwe, the body of the physical body of a Zimbabwean veteran is not, conceived or conceptualized as an ordinary flesh and blood body, as one would understand from a biological point of view. Upon those bodies, in the worldview of African metaphysics, are inscribed oracles of ancestors of the traditional, I'm sorry, of the Zimbabwean liberation veteran, long gone ancestors whose spirits are believed to have incarnated in the bodies of the veteran who is expropriating land today, in the bodies of the veteran who fought the liberation war. So he does not fight the liberation war using his own energy as a human being who would have eaten, and where the carbohydrates he would have eaten are converted into energy, or sugar converted into energy, and then he is able to run, to shoot at his enemies, and so on. He can actually do that sometimes when at the point of starvation, a spirit can seize them, an ancestral spirit can seize them and use their bodies. To the extent that there was a prophecy given by one great mother in the Shona ancestry called Nehanda, who prophesied when he was killed by the colonial forces to say my bones shall rise again. By that, she did not mean there was going to be a physical resurrection like that of Jesus Christ, but it was some kind of spiritual incarnation of those spiritual forces. So masculinities in the context of Zimbabwe are spiritually constructed also, something which is really not the case when one looks at the late Roman Republic smart scenario. A veteran is a superhero in terms of his acts of valor and exploits solely depending upon his human skills and his abilities as a human being. I've not yet seen in proper history, historical context, an individual who was powered by any other force behind the force of investing in training in the body, the skills that would give one the invincibility, an invincibility as a great soldier, as a great fighter. That's one difference. Although there could be some overlaps here and there that, of course, in both societies, these are pretty traditional societies which could appeal to, you know, gods and so on and so forth. But when it really comes to the art of war, the art of fighting in a battle, that difference is marked in terms of how masculinity of an African warrior is constructed and how a masculinity of a Roman soldier is constructed. That element of spirituality for me is very important and is a very interesting difference when one looks at the two. Over to you, Miranda. I'm not too sure whether I have time to continue going on with this differentiation.
Well, I wonder if I could maybe ask you to continue it, but add in a piece, especially as you've brought up ideas of spirituality. I'm wondering if that relates to ideas of madness during war and how this was seen.
There is a relationship. It is quite related because when one is seized by a spirit, they cease to, in fact, their mental faculties are in a way suspended, and they are sort of existing as a medium of a superior power that has seized them. This is the context of purely African traditional religion. And this is where boundaries of normal behavior are crossed and traversed, such that it is possible now to delve into this interesting concept of a war madness. We have interesting examples of Liberation War veterans currently who behave like they've lost their mind whenever an opportunity is presented to them to, you know, relate or discuss about the war in which they participated, whenever things get emotional about land redistribution, and whenever they are pushing for a cause to do with their remuneration, they tend to get mad in terms of the actions that they do. And it is here where I try to conceptualize and understand this kind of behavior through the notion of the concept of warfare madness, which is also quite a result of many other factors depending on where one is standing. Psychologists could do it otherwise and prescribe a different explanation. Historians could do it otherwise. Religionists could do it otherwise and prescribe a different explanation to that. But it is quite important that notions of warfare madness are rampant in the two societies. And Lucan, for example, does mention such. Lucan mentions he mentions furious, for example, furious or madness, alluding to, for example, the feelings of violent warfare, and also, if you want, there are several places where Lucan refers to the madness of war, which he calls belly furious, in book five, if I'm not mistaken. And I also try to ask questions whether there could be a connection between that kind of madness and issues to do with sexuality, because I was trying to explain why veterans, for example, in the setup of contemporary Zimbabwe, accusations or allegations have been labeled against them to do with a certain behavior where they tended not to respect women, and cases of rape, cases of murder. And Lucan really gives a very interesting account of how such things were implied in ancient Rome during the civil war between Pompey and Caesar in his Pharsalia, especially when one looks at book five. So I was looking at that, also extending discussion to look at how such stories occurs in other places. For example, the story of Sophocles in Cicero, that Sophocles viewed the sexual desire of his youth as a wild and furious master, domino aggressed ac furioso. So wildness and fury for Lucan and also for Sophocles and for Cicero, if you want, they have an association with sexuality. So terms such as saevus, as given by Lucan, for example, unmistakably connotes wildness and fury, and they possibly have connotations to sexuality. So it is interesting how one could even develop the concept of war, or the concept of warfare madness, in the two societies as a category to explain certain behavior by veterans in both societies, because it is quite an interesting phenomenon occurring in both contexts. So yeah, this is perhaps what I could say for now, Miranda.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you so much for adding that in. I think it's a really interesting to see those relationships and the way they kind of, as you said, make sense of what's happening. Can I ask perhaps a almost final question? So my question is about sort of the relationship between veterans on the ground, sort of rank and file veterans.
Oh, yes.
Mm. And generals, the people in charge of them, because that's quite often a complicated relationship, right? Both sides need each other, but don't always agree. How can we understand claims from veterans saying, I deserve land, I've done all this heroism, I've been valorous, I've put myself on the line and sacrificed, I want land? Is that a claim to the generals, kind of, you owe us? Is that a performance for the whole of society? How do we think about that claim for land when it comes to the relationship between leaders and followers?
Thanks very much, Miranda. A very rich question, detailed and fascinating and also complicated. I would say, when looking at the two societies that I compare in the book, let me begin by saying there is a cultural particularity, or cultural particularities, of constructions and performance of violence, or performance of masculinity, if you want. And of course, the different repertoires of cultural knowledge from where veterans draw such for purposes of appropriation. And the veteran's perception of those whose land or property is expropriating, we need to understand that it was mediated by norms of heroic and combat and martial combat, point number one. When a veteran does that, he sometimes, these are the rules of violence and how violence sometimes manifests itself in society. Generals were never invincible or indomitable. Even Julius Caesar himself, scholars tried to show the other side of his invisibility, but there were actual places where he had to cut compromises and to cut deals with these soldiers when he saw that he was almost going to lose it. So veterans, when they make a claim for rewards, for land, for property, or for anything for their benefit, if the general is weak, they run over him and get what they want. If the general is strong, they try to negotiate. By the way, especially the late Roman Republic veterans are quite sophisticated and intelligent. There are scenarios where speeches have been studied or analyzed. Generals giving speeches to their hordes of veterans, for example, Caesar himself. If you study some of those speeches, one would see that sometimes Caesar conceded because he had his back against the wall as a result of what the veterans could do if he were to proceed with a certain course of action which was not favorable to his forces. So veterans did all sorts of things depending on the situation. And I'm not saying they always got it right, but the underlying factor perhaps in terms of their dealings is perhaps to say they claimed for land simply because they could take it. They could get it by force. They had what it takes for them to get it. Even against the wishes of their leader, they could do it. Even against the wish of society, they could do it. But sometimes in the face of a very strong general, sometimes they tended to negotiate and they obviously didn't get things their way in each and every situation. Coming to contemporary Zimbabwe, the kind of seesaw sort of thing played out where, for instance, the general sometimes could convince them to wait, and they waited since 1980 after independence without any meaningful land redistribution program happening for them to benefit, for them to get land, until 20 years later in the year 2000, when they said enough is enough and they started to invade land and the police could not do anything about it. So yes, it is about how ideals of martial combat, appropriated by war veterans to suit their goals, and according to a specific situation, sometimes they took the route of negotiating. There's a section in my book where I discuss Dio Cassius. It doesn't occur to my mind what book it was, where veterans actually went to the capital and discussed among themselves the course of action involving the impasse that was existing between Marcus Antonius and Octavian, and how matters to do with their rewards were supposed to be handled. They had to determine the course of action themselves when their generals were at a stalemate and when things were not moving. But they came together and put in motion a process that enabled them eventually to get something out of it when eventually Andon and Bakandon and Octavian eventually agreed to divide between themselves some provinces, wherein also eventually the veterans were allocated some land. If you really closely look at that book, that story, you would see that it is a very long story with vicissitudes, changing fortunes, sometimes disadvantaging the veteran at the advantage of the general, sometimes disadvantaging the general to the advantage of the veteran. And it's not a straightforward or one way of seeing it. But veterans could do both negotiation and sometimes an appropriation of violence and masculine ideas to achieve what they wanted. I hope I've answered the question, Miranda.
No, absolutely. And I think it tied together a lot of things that we've been discussing throughout. So thank you for that. I know we've taken quite a lot of your time, so I just have one final question. This obviously was a big project to put these two cases in conversation with each other. But it is obviously done. People can go read it. You're no longer having to write it. So is there anything you're currently working on, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this topic, that you'd like to briefly highlight to the audience?
Thank you very much, Miranda, for that question. Yes, I am working on another book. But the nature of this book is such that it is a joint project, joined in the sense that I am looking at the study, teaching, and research of classics in an African context. And the provisional title of the book is Classics in Africa, : Intercultural and Postcolonial Dialogue. So in a nutshell, this book looks at approaches to the study, teaching, and research of classics, which actually differ depending on where one comes from. Traditional classics is interpreted, traditional classics is read, traditional classics is studied using mainly the Euro-American ways of knowing. I would give an example. When I teach about cupids or nymphs to an African student, an African class, the questions that they ask me, I have to be very sensitive to them. I don't have to laugh because I understand that their worldview is unlike global North worldview, not secular. They actually believe that a nymph or a cupid is real. Because in African spirituality, spirituality is a real thing. But when it comes to global North epistemic approaches, they unfortunately they are not sensitive to the worldviews of an African when studying material from classics. Because a student from the global North, a student from America or, for example, Europe, would dismiss that as something mythical. When you talk of a nymph, when you talk of a cupid, it's something mythical. They easily dismiss that because of the secular nature of their worldview. So this book is an exposition of epistemological foundations from the global South, metaphysical foundations from the global South, and ontological realities from the global South standpoint, put together or contrasted with the global North epistemologies, the metaphysical positions, to say when we do have these two, when we are studying classics, it is important not to exclusively jettison one form of knowledge as primitive, simply because certain ways of knowledge, certain ways of approaching classics are more scientific and more critical than the African ways, which are more traditional and cultural. So it is an interesting dialogue which tries to understand that classics, for as long as it is still being studied in Africa, there's need also to give room for African epistemologies in its study, in its research, and in how we read classical texts, using, of course, approaches that are purely African in how we understand certain things that in certain positions that may not really hook, line, and sinker be in agreement with what the global North epistemological foundations agree with. So generally, this is the project that I'm working on. It's a book that I'm co-authoring with a colleague, John Douglas McClaymont, who is a white guy, but born and bred in Zimbabwe. But he understands, having grown exclusively within a white community, I want his expertise in a refined understanding of global North epistemologies. And I am strong in the African, the global South epistemologies and the metaphysical worldviews. And then we are combining our expertise in bringing this book, in writing this book, as a way to encourage intercultural dialogue and the importance of other taking seriously other knowledge traditions in the study of classics as a global, in a global context, rather than something that is just a preserve for a white community. I hope I've answered that question, Miranda.
That's a fabulous project. Thank you so much for telling us about it. That sounds very cool, and very much relates to the book we've been talking about, I think, in a lot of important ways. So for any listeners who want to go read the book we've been discussing, again, it's titled Land Expropriation in Ancient Rome and Contemporary Zimbabwe, Veterans, Masculinity and War, published by Bloomsbury. Bernard, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Miranda. Thank you so much for having me.